London Calling, David here. This is another of our Meet Your Guide interviews. I've got our Renaissance man, as we call him, Barry, on the other end of the line. Barry has more degrees than any other London Walks guide, and we'll get into that. And Barry is also a doctor. But Barry, let's start right at the beginning with the Barry story. You're Irish. You grew up in Ireland, is that right?
I am. I'm from County Mayo in the Republic of Ireland, but I've lived in London for many years now, more than I care to count. It's a very, very long time. It must be coming up for 40 years now, yes.
I'm, despite this American accent, I'm pretty much sort of a Cockney. Outside the confines of the Circle Line, I'm lost. So tell me a little bit about County Mayo. I want to know about that beginning. Where's County Mayo?
I come from a large Catholic family, 8 children, 7 boys and 1 girl.
Uh-huh.
And my father was a publican, owned a pub in the west of Ireland, and he also was a funeral director, so he was able to supply the drink for the wakes, for the funerals.
Fantastic.
Very lucrative business. So I grew up there, went to school there, went to university in Cork, where I studied medicine for 6 years, and then I came over here to specialize in my field of medicine, which was microbiology.
Uh-huh.
And that took me the best part of quite a few years, about 7 or 8 years. I belong then to the faculty, the College of Pathologists, it's known as. Uh-huh. And I specialized in infectious diseases.
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of my medical career. I moved out of the laboratory and into public health, into the prevention of diseases.
Right.
So I went into areas like immunization for 25 years. I'm very much involved with immunization and prevention of disease.
Uh-huh.
Investigating outbreaks of infection in an organization called Public Health England.
Uh-huh.
And in various forms of that organization, I worked for 25 years before
Right-o.
Retiring in 2016.
Righto. Well, that's a good capsule account. The Emerald Island, just one more question about it. Was that a small town or a village or a farm that you grew up?
A small town. It was 1,000 people, and we had 50 pubs.
1,000 people and 50 pubs.
Yeah, that's the right balance in life, isn't it?
That's wonderful. And Barry, when you were a little boy, did you want to be a doctor right from the get-go?
Yes, next door to us was a pharmacy. And I befriended the pharmacist, and I'd be forever in there looking at various potions and notions and things and thinking, oh, that would be very interesting. What's this and what's that? They all had Latin names in those days.
Uh-huh.
A tincture of this and a syrup of that. But I broke my collarbone once in boarding school, and I was being treated by the general practitioner in our town. And I was very curious, what's the difference between a break and a fracture? I was very interested.
Oh, is there a difference? I didn't know. There you go. I didn't know there was a difference.
Yes, and she carefully explained it to me. I thought, oh, that's very interesting. So I got an interest in the human body. It was really biology that was my great interest. And in Ireland, you could go into medicine in those days with an arts background. And that's where I went in with an arts background, which wasn't very clever, really. But they had a thing called pre-med where you could catch up with the physics, the math, and the chemistry in that first year. So they don't do that now.
Yeah.
You have to be very much the scientist. But I managed to squeak in the last year that was allowed with an arts background.
Barry, without being too technical, what is the difference between a break and a fracture?
It's a break in the continuity of the line. That's how they define a fracture. And in children, you often get a thing called a green stick fracture, which isn't quite the full fracture.
Uh-huh. And you can just tell by a glance at an X-ray, which it is. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. So you say an arts background. Now, you went to Cork University, but you read medicine, so I don't understand quite where the arts background.
You were allowed in with one science subject in those days, and out of my 8 subjects, in those days in Ireland we did 8 subjects, very broad, much broader than the English A-level system. So it allowed you to do a lot of things, and I enjoyed the arts very much. I would have loved a career in the arts as well. I was a bit torn.
You still do, don't you, Barry?
I was a bit bookish. Yeah, I was a bit bookish, and the medicine did appeal as well. So Yes, I was able to go in, and because they had this system of pre-med, you could catch up with the subjects who weren't, you didn't have, and proceed then through through the medical school.
I see. And
medical school was good. I found anatomy fascinating, the human body quite amazing. Yes,
and at an Ireland university, an Irish university. Is it a 3-year course, a 4-year course, that first degree?
It's technically 5 years.
5 years.
And then you do your house jobs, which is part of the registration. You have to do that 1 year practical training. And then you add that pre-med year. So the total is 7 years.
And that was in Cork then, that you did Cork, that pre-med stuff. And this is you out on the floor of the hospital. Is that right?
Yes, and you do the preclinical first. You do the biochemistry and the pathology and all those things. And then you move on to the wards in those days.
Uh-huh.
And the last, I think, last 3 years of your career is attending ward rounds and learning the skills of diagnostic diagnosis.
Uh-huh. And so when did you get medical school in London in your sights? Or it wasn't exactly medical school that brought you over here, but it was a... You were completing the course, is that right? Or
no,
for the
I completed
training?
My medical degree in Ireland, my basic medical MB degree. And then to specialise, you have to leave Ireland by and large because the numbers of people you see aren't that great. See the rare and the wonderful diseases.
Uh-huh.
So a place like London was very attractive to come to. And I managed to get in to do pathology in St. Mary's, Paddington, in the Fleming building I worked for 2 years.
Our children were born in that hospital.
Really?
It's near and dear to me, that.
Oh, it's very dear to me, too. To be in the place where Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin was a great thrill. And it was a wonderful department. And I had a lovely flat in Norfolk Square. It's the best way to be introduced to London.
It is, absolutely.
In the 80s. But that's when AIDS came. And I was on the laboratory when AIDS first appeared in London. So that was a very chilling time.
Oh,
we
gosh.
Didn't even call it AIDS in those days. We didn't even know it was a virus.
Yeah, oh gosh.
That was very early days in the 80s.
Yeah.
And so it was, it was quite a difficult time to deal with this new and horrible disease.
Yes, yes.
Young people dying, so... It was all a challenge.
And I'm sure you know that Roger Bannister, I think, went to medical school at St. Mary's Paddington. And did you ever get around to Fleming's lab? It's fascinating. Did you go
yes,
in?
Yes, indeed I have. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. They've recreated it there. And in the building, in fact, I was in is called the Almoth Wright Building. And Almoth Wright was another fascinating, if controversial, character. He was very much into... immunization and inoculation.
Uh-huh.
He did a lot of work with pneumonias in the Boer War and in South Africa.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of immunization was quite a big thing at that time with him. And he was the one that appointed Fleming to his post.
Fascinating. Mary and I were living in Gloucester Square. I'm sure if you lived in Norfolk Square, you know where Gloucester Square is.
Yeah,
and this is in the early 70s. Yeah. We... Our paths almost probably crossed then.
Possibly, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And I know you do a walk in. Is it called Medical Paddington or?
It's called Pox and Penicillin. I like to alliterate my walks if I can.
Yeah,
and I piece together a walk that begins in Kensington Gardens. So we start at what's the station? Lancaster Road. Station, and we go into the Kensington Gardens where there's a statue of Jenner.
Uh-huh.
So it gets the theme of infection going straight away with the smallpox vaccine.
Uh-huh.
And introduce the area as well, and take people up then to Paddington Station. And my walk is part medicine, part transport, because you cannot talk about Paddington without transport.
Sure, sure, sure.
With that, then we go up to the new development, Paddington Basin, and end up at St. Mary's.
So, are you able to take them into the lab? Could you do that then?
It's not open very much,
right?
And I've not been able to combine it with a visit to the lab. It's a good idea, but it's never quite come about. But I do take them past the Lindo Wing, and I've got a personal story with the birth of Prince Harry.
Go on.
Yes. I think it was 1984, I parked my little sports car at the back of St. Mary's for the weekend because I was going away, and my driving license had run out. So back then, there was quiet little areas of Paddington. I thought nobody would notice it. But little did I know, I'd parked outside the Lindo Wing, and Princess Diana decided to give birth to Prince Harry that weekend. So when I came back after the weekend, my car was gone. And I had to pay an enormous amount of money for a fine for not having a license and for having, getting it brought back. So I toast Prince Harry's birthday every year.
Yeah. What a good idea. I'm fascinated about, again, the possibilities of the lab. With enough notice, if it were a private tour of that, you know, that route, it might be possible. Is that right?
Yes, I'd have to explore it now again to see what their latest opening hours and what their fees are.
Yeah.
And I think they do their own tour inside, so that would be fine.
Yeah.
So it's certainly possible, but I haven't looked into it recently. It looks as if it hasn't been open for a while. I'm not sure. I'll have to check.
Yeah. I mean, I was fascinated by that when we went in there. It just hung by the finest of threads, didn't it? I think it was... I seem to recall him saying that it was quite a hot summer, and that was what was necessary. If it had been normal English temperatures, normal London temperatures, the culture would have died. Is that right?
It mightn't have grown quite so big, to be
honest.
And they blame it on a spore that came in from the local brewery. Penicillin spore, and it was a bank holiday, so the plates were incubating nicely on the bench. For a period of about 4 days when he returned and spotted this zone of clearance around the mold, killing the staphylococci. And that's what his great observation was. But the story then continues, because in Oxford, I met one of the penicillin men, the last of the penicillin team. His name was Norman Heatley. And he was a PhD student who worked for Howard Florey and Chain. Up in Oxford in the 40s. He was the one that engineered all the kit that enabled them to do the experiments in the School of Pathology there. And I had lunch with him in his garden, and at this stage he was in his late 80s, and he told me these wonderful stories of how they had to grow the agar in the early days, and he had to drive up to Staffordshire in the Blitz in blackout and bring down bedpans where they were made of ceramic in Staffordshire. Now, bedpans are quite broad, perfect, like a large agar plate almost, a Petri dish, and they can be sterilized, you see. So he brought a consignment of these down in a van down from Staffordshire in the Blitz, and he set up his culturing system in the lab in Oxford, and they grew a small amount of penicillin, which they gave famously to the policeman who had his infection in his face. And they had to cycle with this specimen down to the ward at the Radcliffe Infirmary, and the man recovered overnight. His fever came down and everything, and then they didn't have enough penicillin, so they had to extract the penicillin from his urine. So they collected the policeman's urine back on a bicycle back to the laboratory, sterilize it and pick out the penicillin again, untouched, back over to the man again. And they did this several times. But sadly, there wasn't enough units in the amount that they had to treat him, and he sadly died. But they knew they were onto a great thing. And that's when they moved to America, and the American companies started producing penicillin in vast silos over
it's
there.
It's so interesting. I remember them also making...
The penicillin story is amazing.
Yeah. I remember them making the point as well that, you know, if it had been sort of a cleaning lady or a cleaning man who'd come in there and spotted it, they just would have saw it as, would have seen it as dirty dishes and washed them. But Fleming came in and with his scientist's eye, this?
Now, Fleming had been doing research on tears. Human tears, because of an enzyme called lysozyme, which is known to kill bacteria. That's why our eyes are kept clean. And so he was on the lookout. So that's the trained mind and the trained eye.
Yeah.
Knew what he was somehow spotting something that clicked with something else.
Yeah.
And the whole lot came together. So he shared the Nobel Prize with Florey and Chain. The three of them got the Nobel Prize, quite rightly. The three of them deserved it.
And this elderly gentleman, he was a scientist or a doctor, the one you met at Oxford? Was he one of the three?
He was a PhD student.
He was a PhD student.
Yes, Norman Heatley, as I say, was doing all the technical stuff. And, of course, he didn't get the Nobel Prize.
Yeah,
it's always
yeah.
the professor gets the yeah. Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
But University of Oxford gave him its first honorary degree in medicine in its 900-year history before he died. And he's not, I think he was 90 when he yeah. got it. And Norman Heatley was a key player in the whole story and an unsung hero of the whole story
oh,
as well.
Oh, interesting.
And it was an honor to have met him and
yes.
to have had lunch with him in his garden. So it's a lovely way to end my talk because I also remind my people when I take them on the tour that Norman Heatley was the one who had them put the spores inside their jackets in uh-huh. the laboratory in Oxford in case they were... the lab was taken over by the Germans, which uh-huh. was a considerable threat, that they could carry those spores around for decades in their jackets. And when the time was right again and they were able to culture them, they could simply take a swab of their jacket, plate it on an agar plate, and up would come penicillin notatum, the precise penicillin they had.
That is fascinating.
And could resume their research. So the scientists had an invisible layer of spores in their lining of their
yeah.
jacket.
Gary, what is an agar plate?
Agar plate is a jelly which was produced by a famous bacteriologist called Robert Koch, a German uh-huh. biologist, who discovered the tubercle bacillus, which is the cause of tuberculosis.
Uh-huh.
And it, before his time, cultures of bacteria were done in sloppy liquid medium, very difficult to handle,
uh-huh.
whereas actually on a jelly, you have a surface that you can remove colonies from easily with a loop and spread and study them, take them away and stain them.
Uh-huh.
So agar is a kind of jelly with nutrients that yeah. allows the bacteria yeah. to grow in what are called Petri dishes. And they're named after a man called Petri,
yeah.
a Danish bacteriologist who invented the Petri dish.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
And in fact, it was Robert Koch's wife working in the kitchen who came up with the idea of gelatin.
Uh-huh.
Making the jelly.
Oh,
so it was a joint effort with himself yeah. and his wife.
So you're a young Irish doctor at St. Mary's Paddington. I mean, that must have been... there you are, you're in London, you're at Alexander Fleming's Hospital. I mean, that must have been exciting for you.
It was thrilling, yes, indeed. And after 2 years, sadly, I had to move on because they don't let you stay on at
yeah.
that level. And I moved to the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I did my senior training,
uh-huh.
Senior registrar jobbing. And that took a total of 4 years.
Uh-huh.
So I got to know Oxford very well, which was wonderful, a
yes.
very exciting place to
yes.
be as well. And after that, then I got my qualification as a microbiologist, medical microbiologist.
Uh-huh. And was that your first time in London then? No,
I'd been over and back a couple of times. My sister was here before me, and I'd come over as a teenager, and I always
uh-huh.
loved London.
Uh-huh.
I liked the history, I liked the museums. And,
sure.
Of course, London in the 70s was still very exciting.
Yes, that's right.
It had a great aura
yeah.
For Irish people, many, many Irish people.
Yeah.
They know London almost better than they know Dublin, a lot
yeah,
of Irish
yeah,
people.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a stat for you, Barry. I just discovered this quite recently. In 1920, there were more Irish people living in London than there were in Dublin.
Really? I could well imagine it, yes.
But, you know, there were also more Scots in London than there were in Edinburgh. And
really?
And there were more Jewish people in London than there were in what in those days they called Greater Palestine. It just shows you
really?
How cosmopolitan London is.
Absolutely, yes.
And so then, anyway...
Irish history is very interesting.
4 years at Oxford, that's wonderful. So was that like attached to a hospital or a...
Yes, it was a John Radcliffe Hospital.
Uh-huh.
It was just a great experience to get into, understand the nature of Oxford and how it operates
uh-huh.
and the colleges and all that system.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have an academic appointment, so I wasn't in that field, but
uh-huh.
Lots of links with it. And it was a very, very exciting place to be. For 2 years, I was down in High Wycombe, so I oscillated between Oxford and High Wycombe
uh-huh.
doing the training, but it was largely in the laboratories.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And... So then, and so you emerge unscathed and a qualified microbiologist. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so then what's the next career step then?
You usually try to get a consultant job at that stage.
Uh-huh.
And things were quite difficult at that particular point for me. And it wasn't possible to get a consultant microbiology job easily
uh-huh.
in London. And I did want to come back to London. It's definitely
you did want to. Yeah.
I did want to. So it actually happened by accident. They created a new job for microbiologists in those days to move over into public health.
Uh-huh.
Because it was that time Legionnaires' disease was raising its head.
Uh-huh.
And they needed skilled people with a knowledge of more knowledge of bacteria and viruses which have emerged and new ways of control. So I was one of a cadre of people drafted over into public health.
Uh-huh.
So leaving the laboratory and going out into a department in a public health department.
Uh-huh.
A very, very different job. And they gave us some top-up training in epidemiology and all the necessary skills.
Uh-huh.
And I went off and did a master's in public health
uh-huh.
one day a week. So that gave me the skills in public health and epidemiology that was needed as well. And I loved it. It was really nice. It was nice to get out of the lab and into the community and investigate outbreaks.
Uh-huh.
I became a bug detective, you see.
A bug detective? Yeah, wonderful.
To find out the source of the bugs in the outbreaks.
Yeah, wonderful.
We had some fascinating outbreaks. There was one outbreak, I won't name the name of the chain of restaurants, but their predominant sale was chicken, and we had an outbreak of salmonella in the community.
Uh-huh.
So we thought, oh yes, chicken, salmonella, you know, that goes together. But in fact, when we investigated through the questionnaires we do questionnaires uh-huh. to discover the source, it turned out that tiramisu was the source.
Oh, interesting.
And tiramisu is made of raw egg, of course.
Yeah.
And sadly, this chain, I won't name it, had sourced its tiramisu from a lady's kitchen up in Acton.
Uh-huh.
And she had transported the tiramisu in the back of her car without any refrigeration. And of course, bugs love temperatures and they need a little bit of time to multiply. Otherwise, they wouldn't give you the disease.
Sure.
You have to have high numbers. And the temperature control wasn't good enough.
Uh-huh.
The people who consumed the tiramisu in all this various restaurants, a small number, thankfully, recovered from salmonella. But it was interesting, you know, you'd think it would be chicken in a chicken restaurant, but in fact it was tiramisu. So those are the nice, interesting things that you look into.
I mean, this is fascinating. It seems to me that you absolutely were or are working in the tradition of John Snow.
Precisely. It's shoe leather epidemiology, they call it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what he did. He went and found out where those people were getting their drinking water from.
Precisely. And that's what got me into John Snow. And my medical colleagues asked me to do a walk one day, because
uh-huh.
I knew I was interested in history as well. So I put one together. It took about 3 hours. I nearly killed them. And it was more of a lecture than a walk.
Yeah.
And it was way too long. I thought, I must learn how to do this. There must be a skill here.
Yeah.
That's when I stumbled on the Blue Badge Guide course.
Uh-huh.
And I did the Blue Badge while working in 2000.
Uh-huh.
And yes, the job provided quite a few interesting ways of doing it. I do a polonium walk in London for you, in London Walks.
Uh-huh.
And that's the investigation of a nuclear incident in London involving the Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko, 2006. So I was personally involved in that investigation in public health.
Uh-huh.
Our job was to try and risk assess all these venues where Russian spies had been and left a trail of polonium behind them. And thankfully, our investigations did show there wasn't any spread to the wider population.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
We figured it would be, but we needed to prove. So I was 6 months full time on that with many, many others in the agency investigating the fallout from that polonium incident. And today I occasionally do a polonium walk in Mayfair,
uh-huh,
following
uh-huh.
these routes and the various characters involved. But I spice it up as well, not too sad, but respectful.
Yeah.
With a little bit of story about Mayfair itself and the funny stories.
Sure,
about Mayfair.
Sure. His. I'm just going to speak bluntly here. Is his corpse radioactive?
Yes, I think the half-life of polonium is about 50 days, so it does decay. I'd need to ask an expert now. So the amount he had was so huge.
Or was it?
It
Was
was
it?
so huge, yes, it killed him. It possibly has decayed, but they didn't take any chances, and they've got him in a lead-lined coffin
I
at
think I
the
read that in
top.
Highgate Cemetery, is that
That's
right?
right, yeah. Lead
Yeah.
will stop anything. In fact, polonium is the least transmissible of all those.
Ah, you've just frozen, Barry.
Serious.
Yeah.
Thankfully, this was not for a wrist
Can I get you
wider
to repeat
of
that? You
alpha radiation.
just froze there for a minute on me. Can I get you to repeat? You started to say, I think polonium is the least.
It's the most, yes, of all of the isotopes that we get radioactivity from, this one being alpha radiation is stopped by tissue paper, in fact. That will stop the radiation of polonium. But of course, we're very lucky in this sense. It wasn't beta or gamma radiation, which would be a totally different
I
thing
see.
and very risky. But nonetheless, they put him in a lead-lined coffin just to be certain.
Of course, quite a few years before all of that, there was another incident in London, in which a man walking and I think he was a Russian dissident, walking across Waterloo Bridge, he felt a prick in the back of his thigh, didn't he? And
Right. This is Markov.
Markov, yeah.
Yes,
When
and that was ricin, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was Bulgarian. But yes, he was poked with a spike, and in the little pellet was found to be ricin, which is from the castor oil plant, and it's highly toxic, and he died from that.
Yes, that's right.
So, yes, we have these interesting subterfuges going on from time to time in London. It makes London very interesting. And we've had the one, of course, of Novichok, an organophosphate chemical, terrible chemical in Salisbury. Yes.
That's right.
Skripal affair. Yes, indeed.
Well, there are probably more medical mystery walks for you to create, Barry, going forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, it's fun to bring in personal stuff, providers in the public arena and all that I do. So it's great fun. It's very interesting. And I think it's nice to personalize a story where you can a little bit.
And how long have you been retired now?
I retired in 2016, but I went back for 3 months in the early days of the
Oh, did
COVID
you? Did
outbreak.
you?
Yes. They were asking for volunteers to go back and try and help. So in the early stages of last year, we're talking about what, 2020, from April to May, I was back in my old office with my colleagues again. It was really nice to see them. We were working terribly hard. And at that stage, we were dealing with trying to control COVID in nursing homes, and it was very difficult because we didn't have enough tests, we didn't have all the equipment. So it was a tough station, but I was very pleased to have been able to be of some small help in the investigation, and clearly it's continuing. And no doubt there will be COVID walks, I'm sure, in the fullness of time, telling the sad story of what this impacted on the city in time to come, you know.
Well, I've thought about you a lot over the course of the last 14 months or so, thinking that you, of the 75 of us, will be the one who's qualified to and will be taking a prof casting a professional eye and taking a professional interest in all of this and knowing much more about it than any other London Walks guide knows.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, pandemics are very interesting. We think of COVID, of course, as a pandemic. The last pandemic we had in the world was HIV. That was actually a pandemic, but a much more slow one. Much, much more slower. That's fascinating. And of course, we have the Spanish flu and the Black Death and those things. So those are technically the pandemics.
Yeah. Barry, you mentioned.
The London plague actually wasn't a pandemic.
Oh, it wasn't.
No, it was just isolated to England at that time.
Oh, that's interesting. That's
Yes.
interesting. Because the Black Death was not isolated, was it, at all?
No, and that spread all around the world.
So that's a
Beginning.
pandemic, isn't it? That
That's
was a
right. That's the
pandemic, yeah.
definition of a pandemic, yes. And they believe the source of the Black Death was in the Crimea, where they were catapulting bodies over the walls of Kaffa. They
Oh
were
my God.
besieging Kaffa, and they decided the way that they could do it was using bioterrorism by catapulting these poor dead victims with the bacteria over the walls into the city to kill the people. And that's the story of how it began. And from there, it went to Genoa and the ports of Italy. in trade vessels and so on. So, and England, of course, was affected as well, like every other country.
Barry, a while back you mentioned Legionnaires' disease. One, was that a pandemic? And two, what is that? I've heard of it.
No, Legionnaires isn't a pandemic. Legionnaires is a disease that comes from mainly aerosol and through air conditioning units, used to be the major source. And it all began in Philadelphia at a Legionnaires' convention.
Ergo the name.
Elderly, retired men attending this convention all came down with a mysterious pneumonia, and nobody could figure out. So the team from CDC Atlanta went in, and they did a full investigation, and they tested the water, and they kept the agar plates going for longer than usual, and slowly the small bacterium Legionella appeared. And it was the first time it was identified, and they called it Legionnaires, Legionnaires' disease after the Legionnaires. In the military men that were affected. And that we still get it, and it's still through aerosol-generating devices. So it's still air conditioning. It can be jacuzzis and things like that that aren't maintained.
Yeah.
But there's very strict maintenance now of those things, and we have much fewer cases, thankfully.
Yeah.
And they tend to be single cases. You don't get outbreaks,
I see.
By and large.
Unless, I see.
It's unusual. It is possible, but it's not the big diseases.
I'm sure everybody listening to this is going to be urging me to ask you, what's the prognosis for COVID? Are the vaccines going to checkmate this thing? Are we going to stay ahead of it with or catch up with it and see it off?
I think we're in a good place in Britain at the moment, that we obviously have protected now a huge swathe of our vulnerable population. So I think it'd be quite hard for another strain to come in and you know, affect that group. There'll be some cross-protection from the vaccines. We may need a booster in the winter. There's a slight tweak in it that'll boost up our immunity. So I think we're in a very good position. It's not to say this Indian strain couldn't take off, but Public Health England, my colleagues working there, are now doing what they're calling cocooning. So whenever they do get the strain, they try to immunize around that person and also do a lot of testing to pick up any other cases. So I think that'll be the strategy going forward now for anything new that appears. And currently in Wandsworth and Lambeth, they're doing mass testing in the boroughs there.
Are they?
To pick up cases around individual cases and then that way damp it down. Yes, we can't predict. Viruses are totally unpredictable.
Are they?
The one thing about a virus, it's incredible. Anyone who thinks you can predict a virus, you're wrong. It can never be predicted what way it'll go. But all the omens are suggesting now that we're in a good place at the moment in Britain. You know.
Is a virus a living thing?
No, it's not. It's a strip of nuclear material. It's quite amazing. But it needs human tissue to multiply and to survive. So it's not in the virus' interest to kill us all, because it'll have nowhere to go if it does. It works on a system of enough to cause mischief, but not enough to kill everybody.
And I'm just...
Especially COVID is dangerous. It's a dangerous virus.
Will there have been people in the last 5 years, they'd be specialists, experts like yourself, who saw this coming or thought that this something like this could arrive? I mean, the layman, and I regard myself as a layman, you know, this just came right out of the blue. I mean, I never thought in my life, in the 21st century, or even the second half of the 20th century, that I would lose. Well, we're already on the second year. That's the lost year.
It is incredible. I spent 25 years doing emergency planning as part of my job, and biological agents there. And we were so focused on flu.
And
the coronavirus is quite a different virus in many, many ways. And the strategies for dealing with it are so different. The Far East had experience of coronavirus with SARS. And there's a thing called MERS, which was Middle Eastern coronavirus in camels in the Middle East. And I think we didn't learn enough from those to think that could this be another, could it mutate and cause a pandemic? I don't even think the experts who dealt with those thought that could be the case, because we escaped lightly from both of those in this country. Nobody saw, flu was a big thing, really. And for 25 years, we're expecting a pandemic. And of course, it came with the swine flu.
Uh-huh.
That then turned out to be mild, and we're all then criticized for going over the top on trying to control it. Flu is still there, could still happen. There's a lot of transmission still between ducks and humans and pigs that in the cause flu every year to appear.
Uh-huh.
But it could be, who knows, maybe coronavirus will be the new flu and we'll have to have annual jabs against it.
Yes.
Certainly will hang around for a number of years. We're not going to see the back of this virus for probably a long time.
Uh-huh.
But sure. Hopefully the most vulnerable people will be protected against it.
Surely we can be confident, though, that science, and especially medical science, will have learned a great deal about this phenomenon, won't they, from this experience?
Oh, absolutely. It's fantastic what's gone on. I think people understand epidemiology now. If you were to say the R number and the reproduction number to people 2 years ago, what's that? Well, that's when the pandemic takes off.
And, yeah.
Also, the work on the vaccines has been nothing short of Nobel Prize winning work. And I'm sure there'll be a shower of Nobel Prizes there. For to produce a vaccine in 1 year is unheard of. It
really
takes 10 years of careful studies and everything, and it's been done safely with amazing effect. And so again, I think we probably will see childhood diseases vaccines will now go along this new method of mRNA, messenger RNA, and less of the side effects that we had from childhood vaccines. And possibly, who knows, we might have a single jab that will take care of all the childhood diseases, from diphtheria to tetanus to measles, mumps, rubella. Goodness sake, it'd be magnificent if that technology could possibly work and give us the protection we need against all those in one jab.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't think it's impossible at all.
So
it's been a quantum leap in vaccinology.
So what has enabled this quantum leap? How did they take it? What?
Yes, it's amazing. I think the technology has been bubbling along for some time. In Oxford, they've been working on the Ebola vaccine, and they use this adenovirus technology. And as soon as they heard of this problem in China, they switched over to producing their adenovirus vaccine straight away.
Really?
And of course, that gave them a huge head start. So they'd done work on a previous disease, which enabled them to switch over to this disease. The mRNA is fantastic technology, and it's the two Turkish scientists working in Germany came up with that, taking a strip of RNA, unheard of. And, you know, keeping it at minus 70 degrees, you know, and such things have never been done before in vaccinology. Again, they had been experimenting and working on all the careful studies of that before it came, and they were just able to switch on with it straight away. It's remarkable work.
It's exciting and moving. It's a wonderful story.
It's thrilling, thrilling. Yeah. And the fact that I think even with all the political divisions around the world, all the scientists shared the code. As soon as the code was sent out into the internet by the Chinese authorities, the next day they were on the case. It was just amazing.
Amazing.
All you need is to have that genetic code now, and you can adapt it to any new vaccine.
Yeah. So that will ultimately have to do with computers and the interconnectedness of the world, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But it is fascinating. I mean, when we were studying and preparing our business plans for major emergency in the country, pandemic was number one. But nobody could have thought that this virus, above all viruses, would be the one to do it. And where it's come from, of course, is still a mystery.
Yes.
It's thought to still come from bats. And there's an ecological aspect of this, of course, is we're increasingly going into forests, changing ecologies. Viruses there in animals are easily transmissible over to humans.
Uh-huh.
And we've got to treat nature more gently, maybe.
Yeah.
So there's a lesson there for the climate war change and ecology as well for the future, if we want to stop this sort of thing happening. And I think minds will be sharpened now to actually seriously take that on board. So that might be a good thing.
You've put that so beautifully. We need to treat nature more gently. I love the way you put that. Barry, I want to know, I mean, you've obviously been a very, very busy man with that career. How in the world did you find time to do these? Because you've got these art degrees, because You sometimes guide things that have nothing much to do with medicine, I think. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I always loved art. I would have probably gone to art school if I hadn't gone to medicine, I think.
Uh-huh.
But I actually liked art history, but that wasn't a subject you could easily study in Ireland in my day.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't really an option. And I read the obituary of Anthony Blunt when he died.
Uh-huh.
And I was just intrigued by the subject of art, that he was an art historian. I'd never even heard of the term growing up. It was not on the radar of my growing up at all. And to think that there was an institute for art history, that one could study the history of art in this academic way, was a revelation. And when I came to London, I decided, while I was still doing pathology during the day, thankfully the hours were quite manageable, I could still do a BA in the evening. So I went off for 4 years to Birkbeck and did a BA in the nighttime on Renaissance and Roman art. So I got my BA. Some of my colleagues thought I wasn't concentrating maybe enough on my career and I should be doing more on that side. But I was happy doing my art history at night and my bacteriology in the day, you know. You do what you like, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So I've always been interested in art history, and I thought at one stage I might move over into it, but no, I kept on with my medicine.
Uh-huh.
And I was recently able to do an MA at the Courtauld, where Anthony Blunt taught, of course, and I did an MA in Persian art, which again fascinates me. I know a reasonable amount about Western art, but Asian art is a completely different thing. It's more decorative, and understanding the images there are fascinating. So I've been lucky enough to be able to travel as well in my career and see a lot of Islamic art around the world. So, but doing Persia was fantastic. In the period we're doing a 17th century Safavid art.
Uh-huh.
But the Ottomans and the Mughals get all the attention in the 17th century.
Uh-huh.
But in the middle are the Safavids, the Persians, and a brilliant history. And I was lucky enough to have got to Isfahan, the most beautiful city in the world.
Is it? I've never heard of it.
Really out of this world. And as soon as you can get, you know, the politics sorted out and our relationship with Iran, I would rush to it again.
Tell me about it. Why is it the most beautiful city in the world? What?
In the terms of, there's this enormous square, which is about 10 times the size of Trafalgar Square, built in the 1600s by Shah Abbas. And it's got caravanserais and shops. It's got palace and two fantastic mosques leading off it. And those mosques are draped like wallpaper in blue tiles, like nothing you've ever seen. You can barely make out a contour. It's just like a wrapping. It's beautiful. And the ceramics, the blue ceramics of that part of the world are like nothing else in the world. It's just thrilling. So it was a real joy to spend a year studying with my professor at the Courtauld, who's an expert in Isfahan.
Uh-huh.
And understanding how that city came about and the history and the religion and all the other aspects of Persia.
Is it possible to do have you done a Persian art tour for us in the British Museum?
No, I could do one at the Victorian Albert Museum.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there's a big exhibition coming up. Epic Iran is about to start there. Uh-huh. It's been delayed because of COVID. But there will be all the other stuff there, the fantastic carpets. That's another thing I'd never studied before, is carpets.
Uh-huh.
It's a fabulous subject. So yes, the V&A is a treasure house. And in the British Museum as well, in the Islamic Gallery, there's quite a lot of Persia. So easily able to do Persian tours.
Yeah. You know, I don't use the word lightly when I describe you as the Renaissance man. How many medical tours have you got? And then I'm going to ask how many art tours have you got?
I have not counted them recently, but I'd say I must have about 12 medical ones.
Uh-huh.
I do the one on bladder stones in Covent Garden. That's the Lost Hospitals of Covent Garden.
That's
an interesting one. Hardy Street I do for you. John Snow, Medical Bloomsbury. The Knife Man tour hopefully resume when the College of Surgeons, the Hunter Arian, reopens very soon. Hopefully we'll be able to resume that interesting tour. So there's a whole variety of those. And then on the art side, I've done various galleries for you. So pick out the unusual galleries in the museum, not the normal ones. The Enlightened Museum, I do the Islamic Gallery, Chinese, Japanese, Indian Gallery.
Uh-huh.
So there's enough people out there, I think, who are fascinated by these lesser-known galleries.
Sure.
It's lovely to
sure.
delve into them in depth. And same at the Victorian Albert Museum.
Yeah, yeah. Barry, do you
so
get...
at the moment I'm doing medieval. I'm doing European medieval. So
right.
I'm filling in that gap now.
Do you get doctors going on your medical London walks?
I do indeed. Yes, and nurses. They're always fascinated. And luckily enough, through you, being able to do some private walks as well for birthday parties for
uh-huh.
retired doctors and things like that. And they find it fascinating to wander around London, where they've all worked for years and never really studied it. They never had time to study the landscape of London. So a popular one for that is Medical Bloomsbury. That's quite nice because we do the London School of Hygiene. We do Great Ormond Street and all those stops in Bloomsbury. That's a popular one. But also the one you let me do as well is City of London, doing the Apothecaries Hall.
Uh-huh.
Someday it'd be lovely to be able to do a tour inside the Apothecaries Hall, but at the moment we just do the courtyard and all those wonderful buildings around there.
I hope you don't disapprove, Barry, but I tell a medical history story on my Kensington walk.
Oh, yeah.
About the conception or genesis of the stethoscope. Do you know where that came from?
Oh, yes. Laennec. Is it Laennec?
He was walking across the grounds of the Louvre, and it was troubling him that he was having to ask sometimes his female patients to disrobe to the waist so he could put his ear to their back to hear their
That's
heart.
Right. Yes,
and up ahead he sees a couple of Parisian street urchins, and they've got a long stick, and one of them's holding the stick up to his ear, and the other one's got a teaspoon or something, and he's tapping it, and he realizes that the sound is being transmitted along that stick, and that's was the genesis moment.
Yes, and then he evolved a kind of a funnel-like thing.
That's right.
Made of paper, paper mache at the beginning, I think, and then he started listening without getting too close to his patients.
But I tie that into terrace houses, and that cavity between them, and that cavity serves as a fire break. But it also, it insulates, but it also insulates against sound. If you got brick against brick, the sound comes right through from next door.
That's interesting.
So,
yes, indeed. Did I see somewhere in Hampton Court they had shells in the floorboards between the floors?
Uh-huh.
The shells seem to have absorbed, or crushed shells or something. It was light and it could block sound as well, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
Fascinating.
Well,
stories.
I feel as though we've just scratched the surface. Let's just check here. Yeah, we're up to about 50 minutes. So, but look, can we do it again, Barry? Because there's a lot more I want to hear from
nuggets.
You. So, but this has been just great. Fascinating. Fascinating.
Real pleasure. Absolute pleasure, David. And I look forward to the walks resuming. I think it'd be fabulous to get back on the streets again and share the enthusiasm of London.
Yeah, great. Well, what I'll do is...
Your support all the years. You've been supporting me and doing these esoteric walks for you, which many another company wouldn't have allowed me to do.
Nonsense! It's been our enormous privilege to have you on the team, Barry. So, but this is going to be fun because I will link to this interview. On the each of your walks has its own page, and I'll put up a link that will say meet your guide, and they can get to know you before they come to get to know you. So
pleasure, absolutely. Thanks for the help with technology as well, David.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Barry, and we'll do it
nice
again.
To talk to you.
Okay,
take care.
Ciao.
See you soon.
Yeah,
bye bye.